I really am much more comfortable dealing with smaller passages, but it was kind of necessary. It's kind of necessary to keep this together because of the nature of it. So I want to start by just doing a brief review this morning, if you can help me with that, the first 5 days of creation, and then we're going to spend some time developing that sixth and seventh day, because it's really where the message of creation is. I mean, obviously, we talk about the creation-evolution arguments. There's a lot going on there. There's a lot to be developed, but more than just your scientist against our scientist, we want to look into what the Spirit of God is really teaching us from these passages. So let's begin with day one. Can someone tell me day one what was what happened on day one?
Heaven and earth were created.
The heavens and the earth were created, and what else?
Light and darkness.
And light. Okay, great. Day two. Not quite.
Expanse.
The expanse, exactly. The firmament, the waters above and the waters below, and the expanse in between. Very good. Day three. Anybody?
Land and oceans.
Okay. We talked about how God took that mass of mud and water or whatever it was and raised out of it and separated the dry land from the seas. We don't know what the arrangement was. Scientists have said that they can look at the continents and see how all of those pieces fit back together. We don't know if it was one piece of land and one large ocean, but it is said to be seas. So we really don't know what that looked like. If you remember, I handed out the handout that I handed out had the creation corollaries on it. It looked at phase one was days 1 through 3, and phase two was days 4 through 6. So with that thought in mind, what was day 4?
Sun, moon, and stars.
Sun, moon, and stars. Okay.
I'm guessing the other planets are probably in there too.
Yeah. The sun, moon, and the stars. Now you're right. All the heavenly bodies were created on that day. The luminaries, those elements that set our days and our years and all the timekeeping elements. How about day 5?
Birds and fish.
Okay, the birds and the fish. That's right. So on day 5 correlates with day 2, where the firmament and the waters below were created. And so on day 5, he filled the air and the water with birds and fish. How about day 6?
Animals and man.
Okay, animals and man. And we talked about the three different words that he used for the animals, the beasts and the cattle and the creeping things. So we spent some time developing that last week, and we'll not go back over that. So as we come into day 6, the cattle and the beasts and the creeping things, once God has created that element, all of the stage is set, let's put it that way. Everything that God needed to create to prepare for his ultimate creation was ready. That really is the stage. That's the platform. But also keep in mind that everything created to this point, now we haven't got to man yet, we're at the midpoint of day 6. All of this is going to go away. And we can look at Peter, and I don't want to spend a lot of time here, but 2 Peter 3, Peter notes this very clearly, that in verse 10 he says, "But the day of the Lord will come like a thief, in which the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the elements will be destroyed with intense heat, and the earth and its works will be burned up." So everything that God's created to this point, it's hard to imagine that, but we've watched this develop through these days and kind of taken a step back and looked at what some of that may have looked like, although no one was there to take any pictures for us. It's not posted on YouTube. But nevertheless, everything that was created up to this point will pass away. It's gonna burn up in a moment of time. And Peter uses that to bring some severe warnings out for people who would discount this. In fact, let me back up in that passage a little bit. He says, the present heavens and earth by his word are being reserved for fire. He says earlier that they were developed through water and by water, but now they're being preserved for fire, kept for the day of judgment and destruction of ungodly men. But do not let this one fact escape your notice, beloved, that with the Lord, one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is as one day. Now, some of the day-age theorists, the old earth people, try to use that term, that expression to say, see, it could be long periods of time. But Peter's really giving the opposite message. He's saying time is shorter than you think. You don't have time to waste. It could be today. What they were saying was, if you back up a little bit further in that passage, they were saying, where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all continues just as it was from the beginning. We've got time. We don't need to be in a big fluff here. And what Peter was saying was, you may not have time. We don't know. In God's economy, it could be today, it could be tomorrow, it could be 1,000 years, but don't gamble on it. Now, all that remains at this point is the creation of man. And so why was it so important that Peter, for example, in the passage that we were just looking at, why was it so important that he give that warning? Any thoughts on that? What do we see coming in the creation of man? Okay, the fall. But why is the fall important? How was man created? In the image of God. See, now we're created in the image and the likeness of God. Now, don't confuse those two words. Some people try to say, well, image, you know, one of them is speaking of physical, one of them is speaking of spiritual. No, they're parallel terms. This is Hebrew parallelism. They're two terms really stating the same thing for the sake of emphasis. So don't make more out of that than what's intended. We were created in the image and the likeness of God. We were created to be, in a spiritual sense, like God, meaning what? We're eternal, right? So whatever was created up to this point will pass away. In that moment of time, in that flame of fire, it's all going to pass away, but we continue to exist. Human beings continue to exist in that spiritual form, in that new body form, whatever that is. We don't really have a good description of that. So it says in Genesis 1:28 and continuing, God blessed them and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth. Then God said, behold, I have given you every plant-yielding seed that is on the surface of all the earth, and every tree which has fruit-yielding seed. It shall be food for you, and to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the sky, and to everything that moves on the earth which has life. I have given every green plant for food, and it was so. It's interesting that at this point, people and animals are apparently all vegetarians, you know, because there is no death yet, so the only thing dying was plants. And they're dying because it's a different life form, I suppose. And, you know, frankly, they didn't have to die, did they? Plants didn't have to die because you can eat fruit from the trees, you can eat You can eat, I mean, we mow our grass all the time and doesn't kill it. So the plants technically weren't even dying. Verses 29 and 30, or back up a second, verse 28, he called man to subdue it. Let's just think about that idea for a minute, the idea of subduing it. He explains they're ruling over, to rule over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the sky, over every living thing that moves on the earth. This is really the management process. We're managing, we're called to manage the earth. Now, I can't imagine what that would have been like. I'm sure Ron, in his gardening experience, could appreciate this. What would it have been like to have had to manage a perfect creation? You know, there really wasn't a whole lot of work involved, I don't think. I mean, you know, pick the apples off the trees and eat them. Not the one tree, by the way, but that comes in a later story. You know, we really, managing the earth at that point would have just been, you know, and we're going to talk about this a little bit more when we get into the seventh day, but we were called to subdue it, to control it, to manage it, to farm it, as it were, except that it was all planted perfectly, so the requirements of that were quite minimal. Then in verses 29 and 30, he gives an explanation of what he intended by commanding it, by taking command of it. He said, "Behold, I've given you every plant yielding seed that is on the surface of all the earth, and every tree which has fruit yielding seed. It shall be for food for you. To every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the sky, and to everything that moves on the earth which has life, I've given every plant for food." So all that was created, God gives to mankind. He gives to Adam and to Eve. And he says, "Here, this is yours. You manage it. You control it. You do whatever you need to do with it." And then he closes the verse by saying that it was very good, that there was evening and there was morning, the sixth day, and that it was all very good. It was all complete. Everything that God intended now was complete. And remember, we talked about this last week. There were several times when he said it was, it was good. And I used my own analogy of doing construction, you know, where I would go in and I would do a day's work and I'd walk away and I'd say, "Oh, that's good. You know, that's good. I can see what I got done. You know, we got some walls up. You know, you can see what's going on. And each day, it's good." But when you get that certificate of occupancy in your hand, it's very good. And that's really what was going on here. It was good, it was progressing, but when it's done, it's very good. And what he means by that is, it doesn't need any more. It's complete. Now that takes us to day seven, and this is really where we want to spend some time. He says, "Thus the heavens and the earth were completed and all their hosts, and by the seventh day God completed his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made." Now, just look at those verses there for a minute and compare them to the previous verses and tell me what you see that's different.
Day is blessed.
Okay, it's a blessed day. That's good. That's good. It's a blessed day. What else?
In some sense, he had completed something.
Okay.
That he wasn't doing on the seventh.
Okay, so yeah, so he's resting on this day. He's not. His works are complete. What else do you notice that is not said in that in those verses? No, compared to the previous verses.
Morning and evening.
Okay, there's no mention of morning and evening.
It doesn't say any
He doesn't say that it was good, although he did sanctify it. So there's some language missing in this verse that's included in the other verses. Now the old earth day age theorists advocate that this is because it hasn't ended. We're still in that day seven. So, you know, we're continuing on. That's why he leaves that language out. Hugh Ross and other older earth advocates use Augustine and some of the other church fathers, early church theologians, they dragged him into this argument, stating that even Augustine did not hold to the six literal days of creation. To quote Ross, he says, "Their scriptural views cannot be said to have been shaped to accommodate secular opinion." In other words, they aren't dragged into this argument by new scientific discoveries or whatever. So they were believing this based on their own assessments. John MacArthur follows that argument, saying, "Indeed, Augustine did not take a literal view of the 6 days of creation. He wrote, 'What kind of days these were is extremely difficult or perhaps impossible for us to conceive. And how much more to say?' But what Ross doesn't tell his readers is that Augustine and those who shared his views are arguing that God created the entire universe in a nanosecond." Like that. And in fact, Augustine, you can look this up in Wikipedia if you do some studying on Dage theories and so forth and so on. Augustine actually stated that he believed that future science would prove that the universe was created in a nanosecond. We know that it's important to maintain that literal perspective, whether you want to believe that it was done in an instant or you want to believe that it was done in 6 periods of 17 million years. So he believed that, Augustine believed that it was created in a nanosecond, and that he said, indeed, outside of the realm of time completely, that there it didn't take any time at all. It was time was immaterial. Now, as Frank so aptly pointed out a couple of weeks ago, how the Sabbath passages prove that the days of creation were literal 24-hour days, we're going to look at some of those as they speak to this idea of the rest, of God resting on that seventh day. We want to work to clarify what that is talking about when we talk about the rest. I'm more and more persuaded that this entire display, the whole display of creation from beginning to end, was designed to emphasize this one point, what's really important. God created the heavens and the earth and everything in it as the perfect environment for his ultimate creation, which was man. His purpose for creating man was relationship. God desired a relationship with man. He gave all of creation to man and commanded him to subdue it, to rule over it, to manage it. And then he rested. Now I ask you, did God need 6 days to create the heavens and the earth?
No.
He could have done it in a second if he wanted to.
He could have. Did God need to rest when he was finished?
No.
So then it begs the question, why did he take 6 days to do it and a seventh day to rest? Was he not setting up a pattern of life for us? Mm-hmm. You know, if God had created the heavens and the earth in a nanosecond, we would miss out on all of those brilliant illustrations that we get, you know, as he developed that whole thing. He did that for us. He took the time to develop all of that so that we could see what was happening. And he put it in scripture for us to read and to study to see his magnificence. He didn't need 6 days to do that. He set that up for us. He did that for us as an illustration of just how grand all of this is. You know, we paused briefly and said last week, just imagining being there on that day when, you know, we've got the firmament and the water above and the waters below, and We don't really know what it looked like, but it was just this watery surface covering the entire earth. And all of a sudden, in an instant of time, dry land begins to rise out of the seas. And by the end of that day, we've got green plant life, flowers of every color, blue oceans, and it all happened in a day. And yet we know God could have done it in an instant. And yet we have all of those brilliant, those beautiful illustrations of God creating each one of these things so that we could see it.
One thing about the six and one, I was reading one author, and he was talking about that, as far as the pattern for our lives, the six and one, and having the one day of worship set aside, but the 6 days of productivity, and he went on to condemn the weekend with having Saturdays off as well, and that really we should be laboring 6 days with the one day of. I thought that was interesting.
That is interesting.
So do you think Saturday is a sin?
Not if you're working in your garden. Yeah, right.
Doing
right.
Something.
Taking it back. So the idea of the rest is not something that was even necessary to man until he was out of the garden. This idea of ruling a perfect earth. I'm not certain that. Well, I'm sure that he had to sleep, but the whole idea of needing a rest, 6 days of work and a day to rest, was really even necessary. I mean, I'm pretty convinced that living in the garden was fairly easy life. The seven-day week is a unique invention by God, and we talked about this a little bit last week. Where when he created the moon and the stars and the sun, is there any mention of a seven-day week? It's not there, is it? So this invention of a seven-day week is completely apart from any other timekeeping mechanism that God designed into the earth. This is his own design for us to so that our lives would rotate around worship of God. It's that illustration. The scene occurs in Exodus 16. God is providing Israel with the manna in the wilderness, and Moses gives his instruction on how to collect that. And it really encompasses all of Exodus chapter 16. I don't want to spend that much time here. But the whole idea is they've left Elim and they're in the wilderness of Sin. They're headed to Mount Sinai. And what do they do? What did the Israelites always do?
Grumble.
They grumbled. They started to grumble. You should have just left us. Did you bring us out here to die? You should have just left us. And it's just amazing to me. I do this myself. I forget sometimes. They look back to Egypt and they go, we had pots of meat in Egypt. Life was great in Egypt. Well, they're forgetting some things. So they're out here in the wilderness and they're grumbling. And so God says, I'm going to give them food. I'm going to send quail in the morning. I'm going to send manna in the morning. But then in verse 4, he says, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them. He did this to test Israel. And what was he testing?
Their obedience.
He's testing their obedience, exactly.
See if they rest on the seventh day.
Yeah. So what happens? You remember the story? They go out. So it rains the manna, and he says, go out and collect an omer for each person in your family. And it says that those who collected much did not have excess, and those who collected little had enough. Except there were some in the crowd who did what? They tried to keep it, didn't they? And it bred worms, and Moses was angry with them. That was the test. Are you going to believe me? And then So Moses and Aaron said to all the sons of Israel, "At evening you will know that the Lord has brought you out of the land." So he's promised this blessing for them. In 16 verse 19, it says, "And Moses said to them, let no man leave any of it until morning." That was the command. But some of them did that anyway. They gathered it in the morning. They gathered it morning by morning, every man as much as he should eat. But when the sun grew hot, it would melt. In verse 22, "Now it came about on the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, two omers for each one. When all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, then he said to them, this is what the Lord meant. Tomorrow is a Sabbath of observance, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake, boil what you will boil, and all that is left over put aside to be kept until morning. So eat what you need today and keep the rest for tomorrow." So this Sabbath observance is being observed by God. He is continuing the observance of the Sabbath. Verse 28, "The Lord said to Moses, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my instructions? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, he gives you bread for 2 days on the sixth day. Remain every man in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day." So the people rested on the seventh day. So this idea of the Sabbath day, the rest day, is confirmed by this series of events in the wilderness. That's chapter 16. In chapter 20, he actually pins it as part of the Ten Commandments, the Decalogue. It's verse 8 of Exodus 20 says, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male or your female servant, or your cattle or your sojourner who stays with you. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy." Now he's made it a command. And not that it wasn't commanded before, but it's included in the Ten Commandments. This is a part of what Israel is. And as you might recall, part of Israel's purpose was to be set apart from the other nations, wasn't it? This example of trust in the Lord was partly to set them apart from the other nations, that God would provide for them if they gave him this day. The idea of the Sabbath continues to develop. In Exodus 31:15, it says, "For 6 days work may be done, but on the seventh day there is a Sabbath of complete rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day shall surely be put to death." It's an interesting use of Hebrew terminology there. The Hebrew word for seventh is sabit. And then he says, so it's a sabit, is a sabbat of Shabbat, a Shabbaton. So it's a shabit of a Shabbat, a Shabbaton. It's a Sabbath of complete rest. It uses the same word form three different times because the seventh was really understood to be a Sabbath rest. So it's a word form that comes out of that same word. Exodus 35, verse 2. "For 6 days work may be done, but on the seventh day you shall have a holy day, a Sabbath day of complete rest, a Shabbat Shabbaton. Whoever does any work, it shall be put to death." Now, as we move from the Old Testament, this development as part of Israel's law, we move from the Old Testament into the New Testament. We talked a little bit about this last week. The day of worship, our day devoted to God, switches from Saturday from the seventh day to the first day. Do you remember why we said that that happened? Anyone remember?
To set aside his greater creation, his greater work.
Of
redemption.
Of resurrection, specifically speaking, yeah. The greatest miracle God had ever performed up to the New Testament, the death of Christ, was creation. But all of a sudden, we have a greater miracle, and that's resurrection. And with it, our redemption. And so that first day becomes the day of focus now. And that's not the only thing that changes. You can look with me at Matthew 28. Actually, I'm gonna buzz through this. We'll look at Matthew 11. You can turn there. Matthew 28, it says, after the Sabbath, as it began to dawn toward the first day of the week. So the resurrection took place on the first day. And that message is repeated in Mark 16:1, Luke 24:1, and John 20, verse 1. So the resurrection was on the first day. Now that idea of the first day is backed up by some other events. It's not just that the resurrection occurred on that day, but it obviously begins to develop that the first day of the week was now the recognized day. John 20, verse 19, Jesus appears to the disciples on the second time he appears to them. It says, when therefore it was evening on that day, the first day of the week, and when the doors were shut, the disciples were... where the disciples were for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood in their midst. So the second time he appears to them is again on the first day of the week. Now, if you were going to emphasize the Sabbath, it would have been the seventh day. But he returns to appear to the second time on the first day of the week. Acts 20, verse 7 says, on the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread, Paul began talking to them, intending to depart the next day, and he prolonged his message until night. So they were still observing this first day of the week as the day of fellowship. This was their day of congregating together. 1 Corinthians 16:2, Paul gives this instruction, on the first day of every week, let each one of you put aside and save as he may prosper, that no collections be made when I come. Now, the whole idea was that they were congregating together for worship, and they were taking up a collection, and Paul didn't want them to respond emotionally to his presence there, so he wanted all of that to be gathered up before he got there. But the point to that is that they were gathered together on the first day. So the first day of the week is the designated official day to gather together, to break bread, fellowship. But it's never referred to as the Sabbath day. It's not the seventh day. But it's never, we don't just transfer the whole idea of the Sabbath from the seventh day to the first day. It's never referred to as the Sabbath. In fact, the command to keep holy the Sabbath day is the only commandment that's never repeated in the New Testament. It's the only one of the Decalogue that's never repeated in the New Testament. So the idea of the Sabbath day rest has really passed away. Now you can go to Matthew 11 with me. In Matthew 11, we have the scene where Jesus has just finished rebuking several of the cities for their unbelief. And in 28, he gives this invitation, come to me all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you shall find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my load is light. Now what happens in chapter 12, immediately following this, I'm certain was not accidental. What is it that happens in chapter 12?
It's working.
They're working. They're going through the fields, gathering food, right? And they're confronted by the religious officials. Why are your disciples working on the Sabbath day? So Jesus goes through and he develops this whole idea. He tells, in fact, two stories. Have you not read what David did when he became hungry? He and his companions, how he entered the house of God and they ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those with him, but for the priests. Now, it was against the law, and yet they were doing it. He says, but I say to you that something greater than the temple is here. Let me back up a verse. I missed a verse. Have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath, the priests in the temple break the Sabbath and are innocent? So even the priests are working on the Sabbath day. Have you not read in the law, but I say to you that something greater than the temple is here, but if you had known what this means, I desire compassion and not a sacrifice, you would not have condemned the innocent. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. And then departing from there, he went into the synagogue. So he takes this opportunity to develop this whole idea that the Sabbath is not a day. We're not talking about a day. Now go with me to Hebrews 4. We were here last week, and I just want to spend a little bit of time developing this idea. As you're turning there, I'll just give you the briefest of introductions to the book of Hebrews. The book of Hebrews was written to basically three groups of people. And I'll point those out to you in just a minute. But it was apparently written by the pastor to this church, this group of Hebrew believers, who was apparently not there with them. He was away for reasons that we know not of, since we don't even know who it was. It may have been in Jerusalem. It may have been somewhere else. But it was predominantly Hebrew believers. Now, it's addressed, as I said, to three groups of people. And if you look at Hebrews chapter 4, you can see each of those groups develop there. Verse 1, it says, therefore, let us fear lest, while a promise remains of entering his rest, any one of you should seem to have come short of it. So there was a group of people there that were sort of sketchy. They weren't totally convinced that the gospel message was all that it was being proposed to be. So there's this group of people that's kind of on the edge, and that's really who the writer of Hebrews is writing to warn. The second group of people you see in verse 2, for indeed you have had good news, we have had good news preached to us, just as they also, but the word they heard did not profit them because it was not united by faith in those who heard. There's a group of people who have completely rejected the gospel. Now he speaks of them in third person. Maybe some of them are still mingled into this crowd. Maybe the bulk of them may have even separated themselves completely. But they have turned back to the law as their means of salvation. They've turned completely back to Judaism. They've said, the gospel may be okay for Gentiles, but for Jews, we have to have the law. We've got to have the law. We've got to honor the law. And so they've rejected the gospel in favor of the law. The third group, he mentions in verse 3, for we who have believed enter that rest, just as he has said, as I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest, although his works were finished from the foundation of the world. And there's a reference to God's completion of the creation of the earth, and his works are finished. And in this passage, he relates the completion of the creation of the heaven and the earth to the finishing of work. Now, he's going to begin to pull all this together. Now, he references, the book of Hebrews just intrigues me because he's exegeting passages. And in this particular section, he's exegeting Psalm 95. And after reviewing the events of creation as a matter of praise, the psalmist gives this warning in verse verses 8 and 9, do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as in the day of Massa in the wilderness, when your fathers tested me, they tried me, though they had seen my work. For 40 years I loathed that generation and said, they are a people who err in their heart, and they do not know my ways. Therefore I swore in my anger, truly they shall not enter into my rest. Now why was it that they were not able to enter into his rest?
Disobedience.
Disobedience. They were still trying to get into that rest. They were trying to work their way into it. That was never what God intended. That was a cursed generation, and yet even out of that cursed generation, there were two who made it in, weren't there? Joshua and Caleb were the two obedient ones that managed to, even in that cursing of that generation, two still made it in. Now that's the whole point in this passage. It's not a temporal rest. He's not talking about a temporal rest. He's not talking about just stopping your work for a day. He's really referring to the eternal rest. And I believe that that's ultimately the point in Genesis 2. God had created the heavens and the earth and man, and then he created man as the permanent or eternal part of his creation. But he had also set some provisions up for the fall. Now, we can drop back and look at the seven-day cycle, the seven-day week. It was something that worked perfectly in the garden, but it would also work after the fall, wouldn't it? I mean, obviously, it works now. Back to Hebrews chapter 4, in verse 7, he says, he again fixes a certain day, today, saying, through David, after so long a time, just as has been said before, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts, for if Joshua had given them rest, he would not have spoken of another day after that. Now, that's a whole thing that I really don't have time to get into, but the thought briefly is that Joshua, that rest had come. They had conquered the land, rest had come, wars were over, and Joshua then sends the two and a half tribes back to their own land across the Jordan to another rest. And he uses this as an example to point out what he's talking about. There is another rest. It really would have meant a whole lot more to an Israelite than it does to most of us. But he's presenting this idea, just to keep it short for our purposes here. He recognized that the promised land was a temporary rest. This was not the final resting place. That's the point here. If Joshua had given them that final rest, he wouldn't have spoken of another one. There remains, therefore, a Sabbath rest for the people of God. Now, this touches really close to where Ron was this morning in Romans 9 to 11. I believe he's talking about the nation of Israel when he makes that statement, but it's almost as if he's making the reverse point. These Israelites, these Jews, Hebrews in this congregation were saying, no, the gospel is okay for Gentiles, that's fine, it works for them, but we need the law. And he's saying, no, you have the same rest, you have the same promise, but it doesn't come through the law, it comes through the gospel. He's speaking specifically of the nation of Israel, and that's Isaiah 53 and so many other passages promise God's blessing on Israel. But look at the next verse. It really brings the qualification and expansion of this idea. Verse 10, for the one who has entered his rest has himself also rested from his works. How? As God did from his. Now, when God finished the creation of the heavens and the earth, was he completely done? Even there, we realize that God was continuing to not work, but to provide, to sustain. But he wasn't continuing his creation. There are no additions on the earth, are there? You know, God didn't go back later and say, well, you know, maybe we need to add something on here. You know, it's getting a little populated. Maybe we should. It was done. When it was done, it was done. It's exactly the message of the gospel. It's complete. It's finished. It's not a ceasing of responsibility, in other words. God was not completely finished with all his responsibilities, and neither are we. We don't ever really cease to be responsible. And they didn't, particularly even on the Sabbath day. So let us therefore, he says in verse 11, let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest, lest anyone fall through following the same example of disobedience. What's the example of disobedience? Not resting based on faith, on our works. Exactly. We're not to continue to try to work our way into heaven, to work our way into eternal life. It's finished. It's done. It's over. Rest in it. You can't hide from God the fact that you're still trying to work your way into heaven. We often use these next couple of verses in counseling to speak of the power of God in opening hearts. But it's really speaking of judgment. He says in verse 12, for the word of God is living and active and sharper than any two-edged sword and piercing as far as the division of soul and spirit, of both joints and marrow, and able to judge the thoughts and intentions of the heart. You may think you're hiding it from God. You know, these Hebrews who are saying, no, we're going to continue to work our way in by the law. You know, you're not going to hide that from God. You're not going to outdo God. He completed salvation. He completed the work that was necessary. And to try to outdo that is really a slap in God's face. What God wanted Israel to learn was to trust him. They continued to doubt and to work to provide for their own provision, and they continued to do it here in this illustration in the work of salvation. It boils down to this. There are only two religions in the world. Can somebody help me with this? Only two religions in the world. What are they?
Works and grace.
Works and grace. Yep. The religion of human achievement and the religion of divine accomplishment. And the vast portion of the world is working at that religion of human achievement. I am almost daily perplexed and discouraged watching my parents who are in their 80s. My dad's 86. My mom just turned 80. They have devoted their life to the Catholic Church. They have given, they have worked, and if you were to ask them today if they were going to go to heaven, their response would be something along the lines of, well, you know, if when I get there, I've done enough, you know, that I... And I just watch my father still trying to do stuff to make sure that he's good enough. They so miss the concept of resting, of just trusting God that he's completed this work of salvation. That's the point that they miss here. And so many people around us miss that point. They're good people. My parents are good people, but they don't understand the gospel. And yet, while many of us have put our faith in the religion of divine accomplishment, the work of God's grace, the completed work of salvation, by grace through faith in Christ alone, yet how often do we give up that rest? And at some point we're trying to take back, and we're trying to wrestle, and we're working because there isn't that level, that degree of trust in God, that he can handle this on his own. Not that we would ever lose our eternal rest, not that we would ever lose our eternal life, but then why do we continuously return to those works here and now? If we're saved by grace, and yes, there is effort involved, it's not that we cease responsibility, we live responsible lives, but the whole idea of working to somehow gain something in our salvation is just a... And believe me, I'm I do it all the time. You know, I'm right there worrying, fretting, you know, is this all going to work out? It's said a true warrior is not the one who stands strong before the battle, nor is it the one who's standing strong after the battle, but the true warrior is the one who stands strong in the midst of the battle. That's where true trust, that's where trust in the Lord, that's where the real rest is needed. To be able to rest when we're in the middle of the battle. And rest in God, as we saw, is so intrinsically tied to worship. In so many of the passages that we looked at, this is really where the real hope is. The fact that we can worship God, that we can rest in God, we can just lay that all aside and trust Him for all of it. It's just such an incredible blessing. And it's really where worship takes place, isn't it? And I said this last week, I'll say it again. If we're not resting, we're really not worshiping, because these two ideas are so closely tied together. Now, as I said, this it never assumes that we're not struggling, that there's not some struggle or trial, but we can have the rest in the midst of that trial. And I think actually, especially in those times, we really strive to find that rest when we're brought to that place where I can't do this. This is bigger than me. This is something God really needs to deal with, and I need to leave it with Him to deal with that. You know, it's just, I had an opportunity to use that this week. I went and got a haircut, and it's interesting coming back to the place where I was born and raised, because all these people know who I am, and I have no idea who they are. But she knows my mom and dad, and you know the woman that was cutting my hair knows. You know, she knows my niece and her husband. And so anyway, she was very interested. She said, "So are you getting settled here?" And I said, "Yeah, we're getting settled." And she said, "So you know things are okay, your mom and dad?" And I said, "Yeah, it's going well." And she said, "So are you going to church?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm going to church," and had an opportunity to tell her that, you know, Ron and I went to seminary together. And I just mentioned that she said, "So do you like that?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm getting some opportunities to teach." And she said, "Oh, what are you teaching on?" And I said, we're going through Genesis 1, and I've had some opportunities to teach on that." And so then she said, so she posed a question about creation and evolution. And I said, "Well, you know," I said, "it's just so clear." And I gave her this very brief lesson in hermeneutics about taking the literal, what the word says literally. But I was able to take that and move right to the seventh day and say, you know what it's really all about is resting in God. And that was an open door for the gospel. And it was just an amazing opportunity. She was very interested. She was very inquisitive. So you can pray for Kathy. I don't think she's saved, but she's actually going to. She told me she's going to church with her parents because her dad is only maybe days away from dying, and they go to the Catholic Church in Loveland, and so she's been going with them just to be able to spend time with them, she says. But anyway, it was just an amazing opportunity to just transition right through that. God did this all for us. And He presented that illustration of rest so that it was an open door for us for the gospel. Now, does anyone have any comments or questions? I don't know if I have answers, but
just a comment, you know, because in the Genesis, by the seventh day, God completed His work. Finished His work. And when you said about, or when you pointed out in Hebrews, for we have believed to enter the rest, skipping down the bottom, although His works were finished from the foundation of the world. And then looking at John 19, verse 30, where He says it is finished.
Yeah.
I mean, when He said it's finished, He's telling us,
yeah,
it's done. I did it all.
Right. Yep, it's a completed work. There's no more left to do. And yet, you know, how often do we keep trying to add on to that? You know, there's something more that God isn't doing for us. You know, I have to fix this because God didn't quite do this right. Any other thoughts or comments, questions? Frank, would you close us in prayer, please?
Heavenly Father, we just thank you for this opportunity to study your word, to take it into our hearts and minds. I pray that we would be renewed and refreshed in thinking this week on how Christ has accomplished our salvation for us, Lord, and that we can rest in that. We don't have to work our way into heaven. Lord, we can just trust in Christ and what you've done for us. In Jesus